Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, October 10th, 2019. Your humble host is feeling a lot better. Because we believe, and I approach this with some caution and maximum humility, that we have corrected two different problems that have prevented people from receiving the Peter B. Collins podcasts, and in some cases, from listening to them if they actually receive them. And I'm not going to take you into the weeds here of all the technology, but I have to give a great, great, great message of thanks to Jimmy Fish Bob Garrity. He came to the secret studio this morning, and he's a digital detective who went sniffing through the code. And I don't understand anything about the code that makes all this podcast stuff work. I'm an operator, not a programmer. And then, through a stroke of luck, or just incredibly great timing, listener and subscriber David Paulson dropped me a note saying that he had noticed that we were working on the problem with our RSS feed. And he tipped us off. He discovered where there was an extra www that had been inserted in the podcast title that was causing the glitch. And David, if you hadn't discovered that, we would probably still be fumbling around over here trying to figure it out. So Jimmy and David and our webmaster, John Gorenfeld, who is in London, have all been working to support me in this crisis. My fingers are crossed. I believe that we have solved both problems, and I hope to upload and post the Paul Leto interview. He's the whistleblower who worked at a facility in North Dakota where he sat on 11 million gallons of spilled oil fuel with benzene and other chemicals in it. And we hope to be able to get that out to you today after a couple of days of delay. And our big story today is about the FBI and a new report from the FISA court. But I want to give you a quick update first on the situation here in Northern California. As you can tell, my electricity is working here in Marin County. And Pacific Gas and Electric, our rogue and bankrupt utility, has turned back the power, turned the power back on in certain areas, and it has shut it off in others. And it's deeply frustrating for people because you cannot figure out what the patterns are, what the criteria are to select certain areas to power them down. And then the forecast of these incredibly high winds up to 60 miles an hour coming from an onshore flow and flowing through very dry conditions, including extremely low humidity in the air. Well, those high winds didn't really materialize. Now, there is one wildfire burning in the East Bay in the community of Moraga, and it's in an area where PG&E had shut off the power. We don't yet have any indication of what the cause of that fire is, but it is said to be fairly well contained, and it broke out early this morning as some of the winds were gusting, but not nearly up to the 60-mile-an-hour range. So we're learning a lot about this. It's our first time having a voluntary shutdown. Certainly we've had power outages before, but the ripple effect, as I mentioned yesterday, of all these amateurs fueling up generators and trying to figure out, you know, how to get my refrigerator and my TV to work at the same time. And there are also issues where we had a rash of auto accidents because the traffic signals are off in most of the areas where the power has been shut down. There are a few exceptions to that, but by and large, it has been challenging for many people in Northern California. The forecast is that these winds fade out by 6 p.m. tonight, and then PG&E says they need daylight hours to inspect all of their power lines before they reactivate the grid. So for those whose power is out, the end may not be immediate, and that, of course, adds to greater frustration. Now to the news for my comments today. Trevor Aronson is a regular contributor to this podcast. He writes for The Intercept. And he got a hold of a recently declassified ruling from the super-secret, un-American FISA court. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act created the FISA court. And they declassified this 138-page ruling from October of last year. And what it shows is that the database that they use to collect our phone call records and the systems that they use to record our telephone calls, it creates this massive database. And under the USA Freedom Act, which is the modest reform that Obama signed into law about 2014, the phone records are now kept by the phone companies, and the intelligence groups have to ask the phone companies to give them those records. But the recordings of our phone calls held by the NSA in Bluffdale, Utah, in San Antonio, Texas, and at the mothership at Fort Meade, those files are regularly accessed, most often by the FBI. In fact, in the year in question, in 2017, the FBI ran approximately 3.1 million searches related to Americans. Now, the rule is that these recordings are made to fight international terrorism, right? And they're supposed to have free rein to listen to the phone calls of non-Americans, what are called non-U.S. persons. But U.S. persons have rights. And check this out. The agencies for which the NSA databases are collected, the CIA and the NSA, during that same time period when the FBI ran 3.1 million searches, the combined total of the CIA and NSA was only 7,500. And later, Aronson notes that the FBI brings cases to court or prosecution about 10,000 times each year. So to prosecute 10,000 cases, they needed to search 3 million phone calls? This is clearly abusive. And it adds to the other abuses of the national security letters, the lack of probable cause in many activities, and Aronson notes that the use of so-called FBI assessments, where they're allowed 72 hours to violate my rights because somebody suggested that I might be a foreign terrorist or in league with them. 3 million times in 1 year? And in the ruling, abuses that were noted by Judge Boasberg include that in a four-day period in March of 2017, the FBI searched the mass surveillance data for communications related to an FBI facility, suggesting that agents were spying on other FBI agents. You think they got a warrant for that? On one day alone, December 1st of 2017, the FBI conducted 6,800 queries using Social Security numbers. Now, that makes it very clear that it's an American citizen. No foreign terrorist or suspected foreign operative has an American Social Security number. Or if they do, it's somebody else's. A contract linguist for the FBI conducted searches on himself, other employees at the FBI, and relatives. And the Bureau regularly used mass surveillance data to investigate potential witnesses and informants who were neither suspected of crimes nor national security concerns. And in its mea culpa to the FISA court, the FBI blamed these problems on fundamental misunderstandings by some FBI personnel about the standard of reasonably likely to return foreign intelligence information means. Yeah. They had misunderstandings 3.1 million times. That is the whoops. The whoops response, which is a favorite over there at the FBI. And as I mentioned, Aronson says that it is these assessments that provide an enormous loophole that potentially allows agents to search through the communications of any American without a warrant. He also notes that the FISA court identified cases where parallel construction was used. Do you know what that means? We've talked about it a few times. That's where they take the illegally gotten data from wiretaps and surveillance, and they can effectively search your house without going there. And then they get a warrant, and they go to your house, and they find the stuff that the electronic surveillance showed them. But they never tell the court that it was the illegal surveillance that initially led to the search there that I'm talking about hypothetically. Now to a great report from Kevin Gostola. As you know, he's a young journalist like Aronson that I have a lot of confidence in. His Shadowproof website is one that I look at every day. And I previously reported the news that the CIA was receiving real-time reports from the Spanish spy group that was hired by the Embassy of Ecuador to manage security and surveillance at its embassy while Julian Assange was covered by asylum in the years that he spent there. And visitors who went to see Julian, including American citizens, had to go through a checkpoint where they had to hand over their computers, electronic devices, and their passports. And we have now learned from reports we've learned from reports that affiliates of the U.S. government, including the CIA and FBI, were effectively spying on their own citizens through an elaborate fraud. Oh, this is a statement from Glenn Greenwald. Let me give him credit here. He said they were effectively spying on their own citizens, including me, through an elaborate fraud in which visitors to the embassy who visited Assange were lied to, told they had to give their passport for ID purposes and their cell phone for security purposes, when in reality those items were seized so they could be photographed and put on a server with which both the FBI and the CIA could access. Greenwald continued, "It's unclear which parts of my cell phone were surveilled as part of this process." The CEO of the company UC Global SL was arrested and released on bail on September 17th in Spain. Assange's defense team had previously filed a criminal complaint alleging privacy offenses, and we know that they had cameras and microphones in the women's bathroom because that was a place where Assange often met with his lawyers, hoping that they were not being spied on in the ladies' room. Now, here's a list of some of the people who visited Assange at the embassy. Lowell Bergman, the well-known retired producer from 60 Minutes, who, by the way, was a mentor of Trevor Aronson in journalism school. Ellen Nakashima, who is a reporter for The Washington Post. Timothy Eric Ladbrook, Assange's doctor. And the actress Pamela Anderson. Oh, I'll bet they got some juicy stuff on her. This is just another example of the brazen violations. And let's keep in mind when this happened. It happened, or at least it was initiated, while Barack Obama was the president of the United States. And over at Consortium News, a good article that exposes how the government of Britain has been violating its own laws and standards by exporting spy gear, telecommunications, interception equipment, software, and hardware to 13 countries, including authoritarian regimes like the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Oman, Qatar, and Bahrain. And one of the prized exported products are what they call IMSI catchers. We know them here in the United States as Stingray. That's the box that can intercept all cell phone calls within its radius of control. Get dumps from the contacts, the voicemail, the email, and in some cases even listen in on the calls. And so this is another serious issue where we see Western governments profiting and selling the gear of repression to countries that it nominally criticizes for the very repression that it is supporting. And the arms export guidelines for the United Kingdom state that the government will not grant a license if there is a clear risk that the items might be used for internal repression. Well, you send a Stingray or a dirt box to Saudi Arabia, that's what it's going to be used for. It's very clear. A couple of reporters under the NBC flag, one from CNBC and the other from NBC News, are implicated in the story I first reported yesterday, related to the arrest and indictment of Henry Freeze, a 30-year-old in Alexandria, Virginia, on charges that he used his position at the Defense Intelligence Agency to pass along top-secret information regarding a foreign country's weapons systems to a journalist. Well, one of the things that outed these two reporters is that they bragged about their reporting on Twitter. And they have been exposed as Amanda Macias, who works for CNBC, and Courtney Kuby, who works for NBC and pops up on MSNBC occasionally. They reported a series of articles about Chinese military assets and their expansion in the South China Sea. And it turns out we don't know whether it's Kuby or Macias, but one of them was living in an apartment. Now, I don't know anything beyond that, whether they're roommates or friends with benefits or, had a serious relationship. But one of them lived with Henry Freeze. So this is a clear violation of journalistic standards. And by the way, it also appears to violate the law. And so they will be caught up in what will be a pretty interesting case of a national security leaker. This time not identified as a whistleblower. Well, the situation in Syria is heating up as Turkey's assault gains more momentum. And the strongman leader of Turkey, Erdogan, is threatening to open the gates and release more than 3 million Syrian refugees that are holed up in camps in his country. And he's going to send them to Europe. And get this. The trigger for him is whether Europeans refer to his military campaign in northeastern Syria as an occupation. Now, I know that words matter, and I know the Turks are very sensitive, for example, about calling their brutal repression and killing of Armenians 100 years ago a genocide. I think it's pretty clear it was a genocide, and Turkey has gone to such extreme lengths to try to block that. It's almost ridiculous. And so for Erdogan to threaten to send these refugees to Europe if they don't play nice with him and use the words that he wants is just frickin' bizarre. So if we had a Syrian jumbotron, the bloody numbers today would be 23 Kurdish fighters and 8 civilians were killed, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. The SDF itself said 3 of its fighters have been killed. 6 fighters with Turkey-backed rebel groups have been killed. Erdogan said he had his forces had killed 109 Kurdish fighters. And the beat goes on. 60,000 people displaced, and it is going to be messy. Now, Erdogan, despite his threat to release those refugees, said that he is going to take control of the Islamic State prisoners being held by the Kurds. And Trump has tweeted that the U.S. has taken custody of some of what are called the most high-value Islamic State prisoners. He doesn't say where they are being held. It seems like they're sending them to Iraq. And so far, no one has talked about sending them to Guantanamo Bay. But Erdogan is referring to his operation inaccurately and Orwellianly, as Operation Peace Spring. I don't think spring is right around the corner here, but that's what the code name for it is. Referring to those Islamic State prisoners, we will keep in jail the ones who should be kept in jail, send the other ones to the countries of origin if they will accept them. And President Macron of France condemned the offensive, wants Turkey to end it as quickly as possible, says today Turkey is forgetting that the international community's priority in Syria is the fight against the Islamic State and terrorism and the risk of helping Daesh rebuild a caliphate, and this humanitarian risk is Turkey's sole responsibility. He didn't mention the U.S. And this claim that 150 American troops were keeping the peace between the Kurds and the Turks in the zone there in northeastern Syria, that seems pretty far-fetched to me. Here's some interesting news coming from the Israeli liberal paper Haaretz. They say that Syria's foreign deputy minister has called on Kurds to rejoin the government side after being abandoned by their U.S. allies. Faisal Mekdad is the deputy foreign minister. He urges the Syrian Kurds to return to the government rather than plunge into the abyss. His comments were published in a pro-government daily. And that's an interesting development, as I suggested a couple of days ago. These are very fluid situations. And depending on who is providing the guns, the ammo, the food, and the money, these fighting groups can change allegiances very quickly. And perhaps that is the route to survival for the Kurds in the current dilemma. Now, this one is so hard to process. Trump says stupid things all the time. But yesterday, within earshot of reporters, he said that the Kurds, you know, they didn't help us in the Second World War. They didn't help us with Normandy. They mentioned the names of different battles. They weren't there. Now, I told you the other day about the great piece at The Intercept, identifying 8 different occasions where the U.S. has screwed the Kurds going back 100 years. But there was never any indication that the Kurds had a role in World War II on any side of the conflicts. And so I think we've got to remind the president that the Kurds didn't support us in Vietnam or Grenada or Panama or any of the other glorious military operations of the last 50 years, except for Syria and perhaps a little bit in Iraq. So Trump is like the bully who used to pretend to push me into the swimming pool and then say, "I saved your life." That would be my brother, my bully brother. And so as the lower-level talks with the Chinese about his trade war have ground to a halt, Trump is putting on his Superman outfit and saying that, okay, he's going to get involved in these talks. Now, I don't have any investment in the outcome of that. But what really bugs me is here's a tweet, big day of negotiations with China. They want to make a deal, but do I? I meet with the vice premier tomorrow at the White House. Now, that tweet, which came out this morning at just before 7 a.m. Eastern time, it has moved the markets. The stock market is ecstatic that Trump's going to get involved, and there's no promise that there will be an adequate resolution. And what bugs me about this is Elon Musk, who I don't care much for, but he's the guy who runs the electric car company, Tesla, and he's got a space program, he's got a drilling program. These are startups of his. And he has been banned by the Securities and Exchange Commission from making any tweets that can affect the stock price of Tesla. And why is Trump allowed to make these tweets that affect the entire damn stock market? I don't have an answer, can you tell? In Hong Kong, the protesters are now focused on trying to win release for Edward Leung, L-E-U-N-G. He has been sentenced to a 6-year prison term for his involvement in the protests in Hong Kong. And yesterday, it appeared to remain peaceful as he was transported through a crowd that slowed down but did not stop the bus that they were transporting him on. The other big controversy coming out of Hong Kong is that Apple Computer has caved. The People's Daily out of Beijing accused Apple of aiding and abetting illegal behavior by the protesters in Hong Kong because in the App Store, they were selling an app created by a third party called HKMap.live. And the protesters used that kind of like Waze, you know, Waze, where they would put icons on a map to show the police were in a certain area. Then Apple agreed to remove that from its App Store today. There's been a lot of talk about the way that Bernie Sanders handled his recent heart attack and his hospitalization. And I do agree that he could have been more forthcoming and sooner. But we're learning that he waited for his wife, Jane, to get to Las Vegas. She spent one day there. And then on the day he was released from the hospital is when the campaign announced that he had, in fact, had a heart attack. Apparently, Bernie knew from when he entered the hospital, but Jane didn't know until the next day, and she waited a day. And this has led to criticism that they're trying to manage the news about his health. But it turns out that at the very same time, when Jane Sanders got to Las Vegas, she learned that her daughter-in-law, Renee Riggs, the wife of Sanders' son Levi, had suddenly been diagnosed with cancer at the age of 46, and she died 2 days later. I'll give Jane a pass on this one. And now to the impeachment file for today. Joe Biden, the former vice president, has made his strongest public statement to date, calling for the impeachment of Donald Trump. To preserve our Constitution, our democracy, our basic integrity, he should be impeached. He says Trump has betrayed this nation. He compared him to Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda minister. But he stopped short of calling for Trump's removal from office. He is content with articles of impeachment being filed, at least at this point. Now, the Biden campaign has also written a blistering letter to the New York Times for their displeasure, the campaign's displeasure, with the Times' coverage of the Ukraine Gate Biden, Joe Biden, Hunter Biden story. And from the beginning, they've been trying to manage this and maintain. And by the way, I'm reading this from a CNN article, a print article, that is loaded with these claims of exoneration, the debunked notion that Biden abused his office to benefit his son. It's never been fully investigated, not by people I consider to be credible. And they refer to conspiracy theories. They claim that the Times is in league with Breitbart, Russian propaganda, and another conspiracy theorist, John Solomon, who is slammed or smeared as a regular Hannity guest. John Solomon's done a lot of great work exposing things that the corporate media doesn't want to touch. So this will backfire on Biden. It's never good to attack the messenger. And in this case, they're not going to benefit from it. Now to today's impeachment file. Two pals of Rudy Giuliani, who I introduced you to the other day, and perhaps you haven't been able to hear that podcast because of our technical glitches, but they are Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. They're both based in South Florida, executives of an energy company, and they have been part of the Giuliani team pressuring Ukraine to investigate the Bidens. And today, in what appears to be a separate investigation from the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, that's Manhattan, Parnas and Fruman have been arrested on campaign finance charges. There are a few other people involved, too, but we don't know that much about them, and I'm not going to confuse you with their names. But this is an interesting development, and it shows that that U.S. attorney's office in New York is not under the complete control of Attorney General Bill Barr. The Washington Post has reviewed a recent interview with Vice President Mike Pence conducted by Vaughn Hilliard of NBC News. And I don't know Hilliard or his or her work. As you can tell, I don't even know the gender of Hilliard or what pronouns she or he uses. At any rate, this person, Hilliard, repeatedly tried to get Mike Pence to admit what his awareness was of Trump's efforts to pressure President Zelensky of Ukraine, and he just dodged the question every which way. And Mike Pence is a skilled obstructor. He's very good at not answering the question, and he did that repeatedly here. And it's clear that Trump wants to make sure that he is part of the cabal. Trump sees insurance in having Mike Pence guilty of whatever offenses he might be found guilty of, because the Senate would be even more reluctant to remove both of them and allow Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker, who's next in line, to serve as president, even if it were for a short period of time next year. So it's getting pretty dicey, and it remains to be seen if the Democrats can pull this off. As I've said repeatedly, I believe that the Ukraine story is the wrong route to impeachment for the Democrats. The Michael Cohen plea deal is cut and dried, wrapped up in a box. And they should at least be mentioning it in the list of offenses that Trump has been accused of. Now, you know that Trump called on China when he was doubling down or tripling down or quadrupling down last week to investigate the Bidens. And China declined, saying, no. That's your problem. So a pal of Trump's, his name is Michael Pillsbury. He just got back from China, gave an interview to the Financial Times. Quote, I got quite a bit of background on Hunter Biden from the Chinese. Pillsbury's comments came to the Financial Times after he revealed on Fox Business that he had raised the issue of the Bidens during a visit to China a week ago. I tried to bring up the topic in Beijing, Pillsbury said. I've never seen them get so secretive in my entire life. They would discuss ICBM warheads sooner than talk about what Hunter Biden was doing in China with former Vice President Biden. So he contradicted himself and undermined his claim, which appears to be gibberish. Interesting kind of two-pronged push by the New York Times today in the editorial department. The editorial board has a lead editorial, headline, Trump wants a fight, Pelosi can hit back. And they urge the Democrats to be aggressive. They do suggest that it would be a good idea to submit the impeachment process to a vote of the full House, and that it's silly for Pelosi to think that she can protect her purple members, those who were elected last year from Republican districts. And I agree with that. I know that an impeachment vote would be party line if it occurred today. You might get one or two Republicans and Justin Amash, who is now an independent from Michigan, to vote for it. But I believe the Democrats should do it, and that it would strengthen the legal underpinnings of the impeachment investigation. And it would force Republicans to take a position that voters could ding them for next year in November. And since the wobbly Democrats are going to have to take a vote ultimately on the articles of impeachment, delaying it doesn't really accomplish much. Now, the other thrust by the editors of the Times is an op-ed under the byline of Josh Chaffetz, who wrote a book called Congress's Constitution. And he notes the obstruction, the stonewalling of the Trump White House, refusal to comply with a duly authorized subpoena from Congress, constitutes contempt of Congress. It is a crime, and mostly if you take it to court, it'll take forever to adjudicate. But the House should instead put back on the table the option of using its sergeant-at-arms to arrest contemnors. Those are people convicted of contempt. As the person in violation of the order is called, especially when an individual like Giuliani is not an executive branch official. Neither House of Congress has arrested anybody since 1935, but it wasn't uncommon before that. Indeed, on at least two occasions, one in 1916, a House of Congress had its sergeant arrest an executive branch official. And in that case, the Supreme Court eventually ruled against the House. So I'm not so sure that's an active option. He also says one of the less extreme options would be using the power of the purse. The government is only funded through November 21st. There's nothing stopping the House from putting a provision in the next funding bill that zeroes out the budget for the White House counsel's office. Now, that power of the purse, that is there. It is immediate. It throws a monkey wrench into the Trump machinery. I kind of like that idea. Hey, I hope you got this podcast through your RSS feed. You can share it with anybody. You'll find it on YouTube. And I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.